This is CliffCentral.com.
Yes. As we always do on Frankly Speaking, starting with something very, very nice and interesting. Dumelang, Rorisang.
Yo, Andrew Levy.
How are you, my friend?
I'm fluey.
I can
hear.
I can hear.
You
know why?
You gave this to me. You did this.
Don't do that.
No, you did this.
Don't do that.
Now I feel horrible.
Why are you going to blame me?
No, my cells were like, this comes from a white guy that's confused about his... black or white, and we can't recognize this. You're on your own.
We reject it. We reject all communication.
The red blood cells tried to fight it. The white blood cells were like, Richard Pryor said, fuck it.
I'm sorry, man.
We're out of here.
I'm sorry, man. So you're feeling horrible?
Horrible.
It is winter in South Africa. It is cold. It's Johannesburg is at a very cold, like 4 degrees in the morning. So, yeah. I see your body is changing because you're gymming now. So you know it's all these new changes,
Andrew,
for you.
Don't reveal such things to people out there. What's wrong with you?
What's wrong? What did I do?
You're revealing my private parts.
Hello, welcome to the show. It's Frankly Speaking. 1 hour of Rory, sick Rory, and Andrew. We're going to be taking you through the black narrative this morning. This is an interesting topic. And Rory, thank you. I know you couldn't let me do the show by myself. It just wouldn't be right.
That's,
you know?
Why I'm here. That's why I'm supposed to be on sick leave. I like, it's going to be a bit odd for a white guy to be doing a show on blacks on his own. So let me come and at least give some credibility
to this.
At least try.
We're going to be speaking about the black narrative, what it is, what it means in 2016, 22 years after democracy. And how are... black people dealing with this narrative? Is it something to be dealt with? So there's a whole bunch of questions behind this. We're going to be speaking to Polisa Diashana. He is the ECD and director of Joe Public. Also got Shaka Sizulu on the line. He's always talking about narratives, I suppose. This guy is a storyteller. So we want to hear from him as well. Rory, but before we get into those guys and girls, talk to me about your own feelings about... what is the black narrative in your mind?
So anyone out there would be forgiven for not understanding what we're talking about. It took me a long time to figure out.
I'm battling with this as well, to be honest. I brought this topic here.
What Andrew is about, is talking about black narrative. What do you mean black narrative? But eventually I think I get where he's trying to get us to, which is, are black people under pressure to live up to a certain black identity? Which then limits their ability to self-express. Or are we born black, right? So you can understand cultural identity, you can understand Zulu identity, maybe you can understand Xhosa identity, being a Sotho identity and so on. Mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. But this universal black identity that would assume that me being black in South Africa and a black guy in the US and so on, somehow we are connected, somehow, right? And those people that do not want to live up to the so-called identity get ostracized. They get called coconuts. We recently had Sietle, and you know how I feel about him.
Well, what do you feel about him? Because
don't get me started on that guy.
I want to know about this guy, because
so he decides to go and raise money and be the face and the black voice for this fundraising campaign for this waitress.
Mm.
And in many ways, he went against the grain of what many black people were feeling. So mm-hmm. The question is he a hero for standing up for what he felt, or is there black identity that he betrayed, or black narrative which he betrayed by getting involved? So that's the question we want to ask. Is there such thing as a black identity that every black person needs to uphold, or are we just all free to be ourselves?
Let's bring in Kolisa here. Kolisa, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Wait, hold on a second. Let's try that again.
Good morning.
There we go. You know, I always get confused which I'm dyslexic or just retarded, because I'm like, it says mic 1, 2, 3, 4, and I always get it wrong.
Can you be both?
Probably, yes. But then that would be dyslexic or something like that. Well, Lisa, you're in the creative world, a big wig in the advertising agencies. You wouldn't call yourself that, but I call you that.
Yes, I wouldn't call myself a wig.
But this idea of the black narrative, where does it originate from in South Africa? What is it? Like, I think that's probably the starting point.
You know, it's I'm with Rory on this one. It's difficult to actually. I'm not sure I even agree with the whole notion of it, but I can understand from whence it comes, because I think there is a particular history that black people have. I think there's a particular upbringing, there's a particular way that black people were treated in this country. And therefore, I think the system almost created a uniform black narrative, if you will, that black people didn't choose, they just had. And I think what's interesting as we venture forward, now that we're in our years of democracy, is what we've got to, I almost feel like we've got to dissect it and to really decide whether it's a black narrative or whether there are common struggles that we share. Because for me, the difficulty with any, with anything that is, I don't like being grouped, because I feel it kind of goes against self-expression, and I think we've got to be very careful. Sometimes, you know, you'll have the likes of the gentleman you were talking about earlier, and I may not agree with what he did, but what's interesting is that a betrayal of the black narrative, or is that just his personal opinion? And I think that's what we've got to. I'm afraid that we're going from one type of chains to another type of chains if we're saying that all of us have kind of like got to toe the line, the black narrative line.
Rory, like, I want to bring in on what Police is saying, because you did feel something towards Sihle that you didn't feel towards our friends Roman and I can't even remember the other guy's name. No disrespect, I seriously can't remember, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, no, I think it's, so there is a sense, so what Kolisa is saying is very true, right?
Kolisa,
I'm sorry, Kolisa.
Oh, good, bro.
I'm drugged. I think what Kolisa is saying is very true, right? That there is this thing of wanting to be collectivist and so on and so on, but... And as an individual, but if you take our historical context into light, it almost doesn't allow you to do that. Too many people, and I think this is, it's linked to the fact that for you to be this black person who feels free and open and so on, there are a lot of people who had to die for that. And many of those people were black. And they died for you to have this freedom to decide that you don't want to be black, in inverted commas. And so there's almost, you're born with this debt that you, this historical debt that you had no part of. I guess it's the same thing as white people saying, I wasn't an apartheid, why am I carrying the guilt? Similarly, I think there's a sense of responsibility about just being black and carrying that legacy of the people who carried you, who died for the freedom that you now use. So that's the thing. I think for me, Sihle, it wasn't just a matter of he fundraised. It was with the attitude with which he had fundraised and so on, right? Which was, it was like, ouch, you are separating yourself from a broader context. But then I guess the question is, why does he have to be married to that context?
Well, it's interesting what you're saying. There's almost like a responsibility, isn't there? And maybe it's not, maybe if you rephrase it, maybe it's not a narrative. A black narrative, maybe it's a black responsibility that you have to stand up for certain things, and that gets confused within a black narrative.
But I think the question is, do you really have to?
I have
to
no
stand
idea. I can't
everything.
Talk like that. Maybe it's to you guys.
Well, let me ask you a question. Maybe is there a white narrative
definitely
that you have to live up to?
Live up to. So it's different in this perspective. Is there a white narrative? Yes. Do I oppose that narrative? Absolutely. but
would you be under pressure of saying, "Oh no, Andrew, now you're acting black, and it's unacceptable"? Would that happen?
I think that there are a lot of white people that will be like, "Oh, you're trying to be black." So that's the kind of narrative that white people have. Oh, you're trying to be black. So meaning that there is a narrative that is white, and you're going opposed to that. So that is my feeling. But this black narrative thing for me is very interesting, because, you know, Xolisa, in the creative industry, we see huge problems with it in terms of the way in which we storytell. Maybe touch on that a little bit in terms of how you feel about the stories that are being told on behalf of black people from the creative industry. Do you think it's a problem? Maybe let's start there.
I think the creative industry's problem is that we are not transformed. I think that's the bigger problem. And I think that the people that have been telling the stories for a very long time have been of a particular hue.
White.
Indeed.
Do I have to say all the PC things?
There we go. So, but I think having said that, I think there is a lot of changes that we are now seeing in the industry. I think anyone who says we are where we were 20 years ago, just even in the context of who's actually creating the work, we're not where we were. And I think a lot of the stories that are being told by people that have lived the experience, people that live the experience. And so I find that our work is a lot more nuanced. I find that, you know, we've got less, much less of the naive stuff that we used to see. But what I do find interesting, and this is where, you know, in the context of today's conversation, I always find it interesting that because of this inverted commas black narrative thing, or this is how black people are supposed to be portrayed, I find that there is a big job that we've got to do around people and their opinions. And the fact that people need to understand that how they consume creative things, whether it's art, whether it's music, whatever, it is a highly subjective thing. And I think there is something that as a populace, we need to understand in the context of, I may not like that, but that doesn't mean that that's anti-black. I just don't like it. That joke's just not funny to me. And I still find us really often, in fact, more often than not, slipping into this thing where we want to speak on behalf of black people when we don't like something. And there is an assumption that comes with that, and that assumption is that, well, this was probably created by white people. Mm-hmm. And what I find interesting in that kind of happening that I see within my industry is that a lot of this kind of speaking and a lot of these kind of statements are actually discouraging the very people that these people think they are encouraging. Mm-hmm. So you'll have a young black team that will create a piece of communication. It will be steeped in nuances from where they come from. You know, there's a lot of people that will say to you, why does it have to always be these fancy cars? Let's have it in a taxi, because that's our reality. That's how I get to work. And you do that kind of an execution, and then someone comes and speaks to it, but they speak to it to say, why do these ads show taxis and not the fancy cars? Can't we ride in the fancy cars? So as you can see, it really gets muddled. And I think there's a huge step forward that we need to take as a people, that we really start to understand what is our opinion and just get to understand it as that, and not necessarily this big statement around what it is to be black. Mm. Because what we're seeing within this conversation that we're having is that, you know, we're not a homogeneous group. Okay. You know, we are individuals. We've got different things that we like. We've got different backgrounds, etc.
Xolisa, you're an executive creative director at Joe Public.
Yes,
so,
sir.
So it's an advertising agency.
Mm-hmm.
I imagine you spend a lot of time with corporates and so on, just discussing segmentation, market segmentation. So
indeed.
To what extent does the fact that a market is black still play a role? Or are we now at a stage where what you're saying, where it's more about, no, they're just people who've got certain interests, be mm-hmm. they black or white,
mm-hmm.
And irrespective of their color? What is the reality on the ground, so to speak?
So the reality on the ground is that I think, first and foremost, we, you know, just from a marketing point of view, there is a lot more focused that, and this is, you know, if you will, this is very economical for the marketers. You know, you look at where's the spending power of the country, etc. And a lot of marketers are having to look at this mass market that they probably took for granted in the past. But what we as communications groups try and do is that we are trying to make sure that when they say to us that this is the market that we want to target, we've got the right resource that can A, understand the market, and B, speak to the market and create work that speaks to the market. So I think there's more pressure on that now than there's ever been. And hence there is more, you've got more work that is being created by Black creatives. You've got, and trust me, anything that I say, I want to make it very clear. It's not near where it needs to be, but it's more than where it's been. And that's very important for me. You've got Black production companies. You've got all of these things. And I get the feeling that this conversation is going to slide down another because Andrew knows what's going on in our industry. But I but to your point, Rory, there is a lot more focus that is being placed on this. And clients are having to wake up to it. Agencies are having to wake up to it. So I think we're a lot further than we were, but we've still got such a long way to go.
I think another question that comes up is that anyone that's listening to us, let's say of those that carry the banner of Blackness, would come in here and accuse us of saying, you know, it took us so long to own our identity. Now you're essentially telling Black people, no, let this identity go and be yourself, in inverted commas. Then the question becomes, what shapes self? What is it that shapes my identity then? If I'm not Black, then what is it that I should look at as a reference point to being myself? And given the heroes that we've been raised with in South Africa and so on, where else do I look except in the political space? And the, even the arts were heavily influenced. Muhammad Ali died this past week, and even his boxing was not separate from his Blackness. So where do I look for self outside of this context?
Just quickly before you go, Andrew, you know what's interesting to me is that, once again, I don't, for me personally, my being an individual, a big part of me being an individual is the fact that I am a Black individual. Now, I'm proud of that and I carry that wherever I go. But what I'm trying to, or what really starts to disturb me is when we then, based on the fact that you're Black, then you have to stand for this and you have to stand for that and you have to stand for this. So my identity is therefore manufactured. And I'm saying that we can all be Black. Muhammad Ali was Black. Muhammad Ali had a penchant for boxing and for spoken word, and he was allowed to live that. He was he's very individualistic in the way that he lived his life. And yet the one thing that he never denied was his Blackness. So for me, that's important. But at the same time, to your point, you know, it's really hard to ascribe this to a lot. I mean, then we get to the subject of youth, you know, and in terms of, I mean, the kind of memory structure that we have in terms of our past. And our youth are being born into a different world where they're playing with their white friends at school and all of those things. And to what extent, you know, do you almost, what's the word, do you beat them into line, you know, and remind them. But and I think there's a healthy balance there. I think that just like any Jewish kid, any kid, you know, you get to know what your background is, you know, you get to know what your past is. But I think we've got to do that, but at the same time give them the freedom to be themselves,
to question, right?
Yeah.
We're speaking to Xolisa Diashana about Black narrative here on Frankly Speaking. What is a Black narrative? Do Black people feel like they need to subscribe to this kind of story? And who is telling the story? And where is the stereotype coming from? Does it even exist? You know, the one thing that just listening to both of you speak, Xolisa, you spoke about you are a Black man. What are some of the Black truths that run through you, through a young Black female, through an older Black male? Like, what are those commonalities that that are part of everyone's story who is Black in South Africa specifically? Now I'm talking about,
geez, Andrew, there's a lot, eh? I think that there's actually a lot, and obviously linked to the history. But I think, you know, the fact that we didn't have access to so many things in the past. So my education story is a very specific one.
Mm.
You know, that's how you have the concepts like black tax, where, you know, in so many families, you are one of the first, if not the first generation, you are probably out of your whole family. In my case, I'm the first kid to go to a Model C school in my family. And therefore, whenever you make something of yourself, what is expected is that you give back. You know, we are not trust fund babies. You know, there was no future that was planned out that you would have A, B, and C by the time when you get to 18. You know, I know very few black people who, when they got to 18, got their first car keys, for instance. You know, and therefore it plays itself out in so many different ways. And I just think, you know, that for me, and I wanted to touch on this point because, you know, if things offend us, there are certain things, and that's where I think, you know, we're allowed to speak up. If certain things offend us, here's a perfect example. There was the issue last week about the duck.
Oh, yes.
You know,
yes,
there
yes.
was the issue last week about the duck.
Explain to people who might not have heard of it, who are living under a cave. Or
God, I'm afraid.
Not
I'm
even in a cave, they're living
I'm
under
afraid,
a cave.
Rory, maybe you know it better than I, but I really caught it There's like a, just...
So I think one news agency refused to show a clip where one of their reporters was wearing a duck because they felt it was...
For Africa Day celebrations.
It was not professional.
Right.
And then there was a big revolt against that, and it was called a duck protest, or what was it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't Whatever know what the hashtag was. Yes.
Yeah.
The dookie.
That, you see, and you see, that's minus 10 points for our blackness for not knowing what it was called.
You see.
It was a big day.
You know what I mean? It was a big thing.
It's a big thing in the black community.
To be honest, I've already minus points from you, Rory. So but carry on with your story, sorry.
But you see what I mean there. Now for me, that's very important because we still have a struggle to fight.
Mm.
And that's why I think, to Rory's point, you sometimes it's such a fine line to play sometimes when, you know, it's between your individuality, but also the kind of statements or narratives that could actually take us backwards. Mm. Because there's certain things that are around freedom and dignity and all of those things that we all still need to stand up for together. And to make strong statements around, no, you will not disrespect me by calling my culture unprofessional. You know, I remember when I went to school, we had a similar thing where the in thing for the white kids was what you call short back and sides. And, you know, all those kind of decent haircuts. We called it German cut, by the way.
Yes.
But the one thing that was not allowed for the white kids was for them to shave their hair. Now, Andrew, because people can't see us out there, please can you talk about Rory and I's chosen hairstyle because we want to be dignified since we're coming to Cliff Central?
Well, both of you have got such a nice haircut. I mean, it's very... I mean, what do you want me to say?
It's
just beautiful. It's short.
It's short. Yeah,
short
exactly.
back and sides.
It's not even short back and sides. It's shaven
short. Yeah, short, yeah, yeah. Short top and sides.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
So for us, there's a certain cultural context to shaven hair. You know, it's how we look neat. It's how we look dignified. And because the inverted commas white narrative was the narrative of the day, there was no place for us in that. And essentially, we were leaving our schools going to theirs. Mm. And therefore, we had to toe the line there.
Mm.
And those are the kind of things that we're talking about. Because when you really think about it, this is South Africa. You should be allowed to represent yourself in a way that's culturally acceptable.
Here's an interesting point because, you know, we've spoken numerous times on this platform, Rory, about this idea of corporate South Africa and it being predominantly still white-owned. White capital we've spoken about before. But there is something in what you're saying, Xolisa, about this idea of going into former Model C schools or private schools in modern day now, mm-hmm. or these corporates that are traditionally white-owned or not transformed, mm-hmm. and losing yourself as a black person,
mm-hmm.
losing that narrative that you're speaking about,
mm-hmm.
To try and fit in inverted commas. Isn't that something that is part of the narrative, which is this idea of... well, I am this, this, and this, and I have to then give that all up, that story, to become, I don't know, watered down black version / black white, you know?
Mm, I think it's so.
Sorry, that's a very weird question. I know it's a bit convoluted.
But I get it. I think, and there is a conversation worth having about how there's a culture shock amongst black people moving into the corporate space, and the question is, in whose image have we built these corporates? Mm. And as a result, what does that require me to leave behind or at the door when I come in? A white person and a black person, do they have to leave behind equal amounts of themselves when they step into the door? And then you expect a black person to behave or to perform at his peak, having left so much of himself at the door. So there is a question, but then again, it almost contradicts what we've been saying about individualism, to say, no, but there isn't a black identity that you're carrying. There's just you, right? Or are there aspects that are specifically that this is just because you're black, this is part of your identity, and this is something that has to be brought in, but there's no space for it in the workplace? Speaking to Model C schools, we grew up, you weren't allowed to speak your home language, as they would say. Mm. So at school, you weren't allowed to speak your home language, but you could speak English, you could speak Afrikaans, home languages to white people, right? So there is the sense where you're constantly having to let go of a lot of yourself in order to fit into, as Kolisa said, even the haircuts, into what is regarded as professional and so on. So I think then there is a question to say, to what extent, and Kolisa, you're part of leading a company which is the largest independent creative agency, I think, in South Africa, right? So you know these things. To what extent do we begin to shape those environments to be more accepting of all of those things, or is it a non-issue?
I think it's a huge issue. And, you know, it goes down, right down to the issue of recruitment. Mm. You know, I once heard a wonderful story from, and yeah, maybe let me just tell it. I heard the story from when our wonderful South African who's gone over to the US to go and head up the Daily Show. So when he was looking for one of the things that he wanted on his team, being a black South African and coming from our environment, one of the things that he really wanted for his team is he wanted a diverse team of people. And so I think if you watch the show now, you can see that reflected. But one of the interesting stories that he tells is how he was looking for a black comedian. And he wanted that comedian to be part of his correspondence team. And he says he spoke to all the agents, they sent out the memo, and they went out to all the different agents. And I think they got something like, 8,000 or so applicants, but out of which probably about 3 were black, and he just didn't understand it. He said, you know, he thought to himself, I mean, this is one of the biggest jobs in the US. Why don't black people want it? Mm. And he says it was until one day when he was on his usual, he goes club hopping, comedy club hopping, and he went to this one comedy club in Brooklyn, I think it was. And he says he got there, and he says the first thing that happened is that all the black comedians were so happy to see him. And they all said to him, yo, Trevor, yo, you got to put us on, right? You're going to let us know when you've got some space for some black brothers up in there. Mm. And he was like, no, but we put out the whole thing for the last month and none of you guys applied. Mm. He's like, yo, man, we ain't got no agents. That's not how we get this gig. Mm. And we thought that you weren't looking for us. So therein lies the point that it goes right down to even the way that you recruit people. You know, a lot of agencies will tell you that, you know, we're not finding the black talent and all of those things. And for me, it's all about, first and foremost, where are you looking? Mm. And it's so complex when you look at this issue, because then you go down to the issue of schools. You know, in our entire syllabus, we've got one subject that's dedicated to a child with an artistic mind. And that's in the fanciest of schools. So if you're a child who's growing up in the Lokshin, there is no subject for you to develop your artistic side. And somehow we've got to get people. So it's an extremely complex situation. There is a part for all stakeholders to play, which is why personally I don't believe that the solution is just legislation. There is a lot that the government can also do in terms of let's transform our education system. Mm. You know, you've then got a bigger issue of awareness. You know, when our parents grew up, the only jobs that were guaranteed to get you dignity and money was, you know, being a lawyer, being a doctor and all of those. Now you come back to your parents and you tell them that you want to work at Cliff Central. Really? You know what I mean? So that black child is not free to do what it is that child wants. And then for me, the end of it is well, not the end of it, but then the next step of it is when they get to corporate. And that's why, Rory, to answer your question, my big thing is, so that's where I do think that legislation plays a big part. But I also think, you know, being a child who grew up in a Methodist home, we say be bright in the corner where you are. Mm. So within my company, what is it that I can do to make sure that the environment is welcoming to every single person, no matter what their sexual orientation, no matter what their race, no matter what their background? We've all got a role to play to actually make sure that that happens. Because to your point, you cannot operate at your maximum if you leave so much of yourself behind.
Mm. Mm. It's quite interesting. I want to bring a real example to the table, right? So Musi Maimane, it in many respects offends the senses as far as the common black narrative. I put in inverted commas.
Yes,
right?
We've all been doing that throughout. I hope Andrew's getting the hint.
Exactly.
I'm learning, guys.
He's married to a white woman. He's leading this party that's regarded as white, and so on. What is it? What is it that is so offensive to this inverted commas black narrative about Musi Maimane on the one hand, but can he be effective on the other hand in that space if he doesn't assume more blackness again in inverted commas? Because he's supposed to appeal to a wider demographic than just white people. Can he do that by taking on a lot more blackness, so to speak? You guys are both in the creative agency, in the creative industries.
But I'm not black,
you're about engaging audiences. So I'm keen to hear from you about what you know. Musi Maimane for me is a practical example of this person who...
He offends you.
No, it doesn't offend me. I'm just saying he offends, largely speaking, if you look at the common narrative, he offends the sense of what it means to be black and proudly black, right? So, and that's why the things, when he gets bashed about, you know, he's a, what do they call the house nigger again? Yeah. Uncle Tom and
yes,
so on.
Uncle Tom, yeah.
Those are the sorts of things that he gets bashed with. What is it specifically about him? And can he be effective as he is as an individual, or does he have to adopt more blackness in order to be more effective?
You see, what's interesting to me, and I think it's sort of where my mind is. You know, my mind's like a parachute.
yeah.
When we're speaking, and somewhere it's got to land somewhere. and I think sort of where my mind is going in the context of the conversation that we're having is that I do believe that there is black struggle. I believe in that.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that we're still involved in that. And I think a lot of what we've been speaking about is about that. Having said that, I don't think that I don't necessarily believe in the whole concept of black narrative, because for me, black narrative has got a thing to do with future. And I think that it can be very limiting. Because in a lot of ways as well, we, you know, the other side of this is that we've got many examples of you know, of pull me down syndrome, where you know, where if one of us starts doing better than the rest of us, then you ain't being black enough, and I think we've got to be very careful that this black narrative thing is not a veiled expression for black mediocrity as well. And therefore we've got to give space for people to be individuals. I think that if Musi Maimane were to say things that offend me in terms of
of what I've gone through as a black person and my dignity and all of those things, that I can speak to. But in terms of when he speaks his politics, the fact that he's chosen the particular party that he's chosen, I mean, that's, it's important. That's his freedom. That's what all these people died for.
Mm.
And I just think that we've got to make that distinction. So for me, if it's about dignity, if it's about, for instance, what we're talking about in terms of whether it's dignity in the workplace, if it's about the upliftment of people, making sure that despite the fact that, I come from this kind of background, I still have access to opportunities there. I definitely think that, that we can speak of black struggle. And I would be offended if someone black or white were to actually disrespect that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there's the other side of it where we've got to allow people to express themselves and to advance themselves in whatever field they choose, in whatever political party they choose, because we are not a homogenous group, as I said.
Mm.
It's a double-edged sword, isn't
it? It is. It is.
Because we spoke earlier about having to leave so much of yourself behind to be part of this corporate world and this world that, let's say, has been shaped in the image of white people.
Mm-hmm.
So you leave a lot of your blackness behind in order to rise, mm-hmm. because anything that is too black cannot rise in this world.
Yeah.
You get to the top and black people say, we don't recognize you because we don't relate to you. You've had to leave so much of who you are behind to get to the top. And now we start to pull you down because you don't recognize anything you are. And maybe you've also lost a lot of, when you've risen to the top, you've gone through all the struggles, you've made it. Then you start, why can't you guys do the same? So it is a double-edged sword. Yeah. And it raises a big question then about, so what does the future of blackness, in inverted commas again, look like? Because in one way, you're damned if you do, if you're black.
Yeah.
Can we think of a single black person who carries this stereotypical blackness strongly, who has risen to the heights of the corporate world? Ali made it because he just beat everyone up, I mean, it's easy in those spaces, right? Just smack people, and they will respect. They might hate you, but they will respect the fact that you smack people around. But in other contexts where that is not a liberty, do we know of a person who's carried their blackness with intense pride and overtly, the way, let's say, an Ali did in the boxing ring, who's managed to rise to the top?
Interesting. Look, I do know quite a few, and I can think of quite a few. I mean, we've got, and it's interesting, some of the examples I think of definitely in the arts. I think of the Brahues of the world. Mm. I think of, but what's interesting as well is that when I think from a corporate point of view, for me, it's when someone starts their own thing. And then through that they actually, but if you think of it in the formal corporate structures, I agree with you. It's really, really hard to think. And that's why I'm saying, and the one thing about this is that it is so complex.
Mm.
And that's why what irritates me is when people try and simplify it. And what irritates me is when people try and paint something and then suddenly we've all got to toe that line. Mm. Have you ever been to something where let's say we're at a rally, okay? Let's say we're at a rally. As we do on a Wednesday morning. And the guy that's up there is just try and picture it this way. And he's like, we're saying down with Cliff Central, down. And we're like, down with Cliff Central, because they made us mad for something, okay? And then we're like, it's exactly the same thing that we were saying about Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson sucks.
Yeah.
And then
hold on a second.
Yeah.
No, I agree to the first part, but the second part, I'm kind of not there.
You know what I mean? And I promise you, if you look at so much of this kind of, not the black narrative, but the narrative that's just going on, I think it happens a lot. And I think for me, it can stifle our thinking. I think if we're talking about our struggle, I hear that, and perhaps it's not as clear cut as that, because how do you clearly define between struggle and what's going on now? But I promise you, for me, that you've got to somehow find ways to make these distinctions. We've just got to. I don't see any other way. And for me, if I almost, you know, as Rory was speaking, I almost think it's about freedom. I think for me it's about freedom. I think, you know, we're not in chains anymore, but we're in many different chains, and many of those chains still in our heads.
Practically, how do we loose ourselves from those chains? If we think about it on a day-to-day basis, you've got people on Twitter that are telling you how to behave as a black person, on opinions. Most of the time, opinions in this country are separated according to black-white, right? So we're constantly having to, how do you physically free yourself and say, you know what, I am going to take my own stance, and my stance just so happens to be counter the narrative that most of, and it's actually, we should be careful not to say most black people. It's the loudest black people who are then defining this thing. How do you practically, tell us about yourself, Kolisa. How do you practically free yourself, or is it a privilege that you can only get at a certain stage? But as you know, no one can deny that you're talented anymore. Mm-hmm. No one can deny that you're successful. But when you don't have those things, you know, you're not going to tell me anything if I'm successful. You can say what you want. I'm still living my life. It's like old Herman Mashaba.
Yes, yes.
You know, it's like he doesn't. He says whatever he wants, and hey, you know, he's still Herman Mashaba. Show me what you built, right? Mm-hmm. Is it a function of just the higher you go, the more you're able to free yourself? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, is it possible to be yourself even at the bottom of the food chain, so to speak?
You see, and such a good point you're making. I think you're right, because it comes with access to information, right? Mm-hmm. And the higher you go, the more access to information you get. You know, you look at it, you look at the people that led our struggle. You know, these were the guys that had access to the books. You know, the O.R. Tambos and the Nelsons and everybody, and what I find quite interesting is one of my personal things, for instance, is that I'm trying to do my best so that the black child that I get to interact with does not have to go through every single thing that I went through in order to get this level of consciousness. Mm. So something as simple as a public platform. You know, I use my public platforms nowadays to, you know, I get, you would know, Andrew, I mean, I've spoken to some of the students that you work with. And one of the conscious things that I've decided for myself is that I use whatever reverence they have for me, whatever respect they have for me, to almost do, I don't know if you remember a Street Fighter, but do you remember the Hayuken?
Yes.
I literally Hayuken it back to them. So for me,
what a reference.
I swear to you, like that's become my whole thing right now, because I think that we need to liberate the black child, and for the black child to realize that anything is possible, and it starts in the mind. You know, I just went, you know, there's a reason why Americans are the way that they are. And it's taken them so long, and they still have things like BET and you know, that the thing that they have with the girls that they had the other day with Michelle Obama, etc. So I think that it's going to take a while, but we have to start. And I always believe it starts in the home. It starts in the home. Like, what influence are you having in your family? Another perfect example, and perhaps this is more for Rory, because, you know, you didn't grow up with us. But Rory, like something as simple, but so interesting, chap. Like something as simple as, you know, when we grew up, you, as an older person, you didn't really relate to your younger brothers or sisters. You know, and they were obligated to respecting you.
Yes.
So for the longest time, you know, it took the longest time to have a relationship with my older brothers, because we couldn't really relate that way because he was older. Mm. Doesn't matter if he's 2 years older. It doesn't matter if he's 10 years older.
Mm.
And do you realize how much of that you've got to break down? Because the person that needs you the most in your family is probably that kid who's 6 years old.
Yes, who needs a role model.
You know what I mean? Who needs a role model, where you've got to start planting that seed now. So I think that from a legislative point of view, we've got a huge job to do to make sure that people are given freedom to be themselves and to contribute to the economy of this country. From a state point of view, to make sure that people are given opportunities, but not only that, you know, not only do you give them opportunities, but you actually support their businesses and everything else. But then also in terms of within our own environments and within our own families, I think that we've got a huge job to do to emancipate yourselves, ourselves from mental slavery.
It's actually, what Lolisa is saying is so true. And I see it in the corporate space where then there's a frustration, right? Because you take that very reverence for older people. You take it into the workplace. And it doesn't serve you in, let's say, a white environment. It doesn't serve you because the guys that make it, they are guys who are able to stand up and say, no, I disagree with you. But this is my opinion. But what do we do? When you come into a white environment, you just see your elders and you just you continue. You take that culture that you've
from
got.
From a respect perspective,
from a respect
right?
point. Okay. And then you're seen to not be assertive. So when the performance measurement thing come in once a year, it says it's not assertive, he doesn't speak up and so on. And what that is part of this black, let's say, culture that you've been raised with. So again, then the question is, what do we do? Do we transform the conversation happening inside corporates to be more inclusive of the black identity, or do we transform ourselves as black people to be able to fit into the conversation that is happening within corporates, which for argument's sake is built around a white image? And I think you know, my view is actually a bit of both,
because
we can't, in the long term, I can't wait for the corporates to transform, right? You have to get in there. You have to do to be your best.
Absolutely.
The issue is that you have to leave so much of yourself behind. But can you be conscious about this is what I'm leaving, and this is a tactical thing. And when I get to the top, it is my job to begin to change things. And I think maybe one of the things we have to ask is, why have our leaders at the top of the black leaders that have made it? So we like to speak about how few black leaders have made it to the top and so on, but those few, why are they not making the radical changes that you'd expect them to make? Or is that again expecting too much from a black person who just needs to lead?
I think it's I think I'm very wary of that, because I know a lot of corporate black people at the top, and they are doing an enormous amount. And I think what we do, and you know, I don't blame us, because, you know, we sort of impatient, you know, it should have happened long ago. But I can promise you now, if I just were to do like a one for one, if you just look at how one person at the top is able to then, you know, conscientize the rest of the people at the top, and suddenly you've got more people being hired, you've got more people being given opportunity. So what I'm saying is that what I see is that those people at the top, the vast majority that I've definitely met, are making huge changes. The question is it enough? Mm-hmm. And that's what we've actually got to answer.
Do you feel like you're doing enough as a leader? Because you are a leader as well, right?
I feel like I'm doing a lot. I don't know if it will ever be enough. I don't know if I'll ever think I'm doing enough of anything. but I'm doing a lot, and I'm trying to do more every day. And I think for me, that's a good start. And that's, and you know, and I always, and I do think it's interesting sometimes, because a lot of people spend a lot of time criticizing, and there are a lot of assumptions that are made. You know, you're sitting at the top, you are cushy and everything else. Mm. And what people don't understand is that often the person that you're saying that about is doing a lot more than writing a post on Facebook.
Mm.
You know, and I think we've got to and I think we've got to be respectful of that.
Yeah.
And we've got to realize that that there's such a huge role for each of us to play.
How do you deal with criticism from other black people when they say you're being anti-black? You know, like, I mean, your example of Musi Maimane was fantastic, Rory. About
they scared of Rory and I. They never said.
Yeah, but I don't, no one comes to me and tells me I'm anti-black.
But let me put it another way. Have you ever had a situation where another black person will say, are you being so white now? Or you're learning something like that feels very white?
I don't know. I can't think of anyone having said that to me, because you live a fuller life, right? So if you're known for certain things that you say and a certain way that you live, it's difficult for a person to say, but this is why, you know. So I don't personally, I don't really have those experiences of a person saying you're acting white.
But when you were with that political party that you were with, there were a lot of people that were, you know, thinking that you were going against the grain.
I was going against the grain, but I wasn't going. It's like saying the EFF is going against the grain of blackness because
EFF
was just, yeah. We were very clear in what we were saying. It wasn't we now want to be white, and people will throw these things at you. And I think what Kolisa is saying is very important. There is no way that you're not going to get thrown at. You're always, if you're going to change a narrative, whatever the narrative is, you're going to upset some people. Mm. And you need to decide what are we going to do and what are you striving towards? And then you just do it. There will be one or two people, but hey, just like Ali, right? If you beat up enough people, so I think what Kolisa is saying is your talent ultimately then speaks for you. Absolutely. At a certain level, your talent begins to speak for you. Then it doesn't matter if they don't like you. You become indispensable, right? And the question is, how do we marry a lot more of who we are with what we do? So that it becomes appreciated that if we take Rory, but we force him to leave a part of himself out, we're going to lose out on this. But there does come a point where your talent begins to speak for you, and it's not because you're black, it's not because you're an individual, you're smart, and you're able to deliver. In fact, I think you're privileged if you're a black person working in a lot of these environments, because your world is so much bigger. Your point of reference tends to be a lot bigger than the white people sitting around you.
That's an hour of craziness and insights that I feel like I've been...
Did you get what you wanted? You put black people in a fishbowl here. What exactly did you want to achieve by the show?
I said about five words.
Yeah, you put us in a fishbowl and then you watched
No, Rory. I think it's interesting because coming into the show, Rory, you know, you and I were both a little bit confused as to where this was going to go. But watching all of us throughout the show, it started to build. There's a whole bunch of issues that we need to address and that we're not addressing because no one wants to speak about it. So, yes, we've probably touched the surface. We probably need to have five more of these shows.
Absolutely.
But I think the point is it's a start. It's somewhere. Kolisa, I really appreciate you leading this. And I know it's you as an individual leading this. But it's fascinating to me, your thoughts and your views. Where can people find you on social media? I see you Snapchatting away here.
They can find me on Snapchat. Kolisa Dyeshana, which is Kolisa XOLISA Dyeshana DYESHANA, and it's the same on Twitter at Kolisa Dyeshana, and it's the same on Insta. I do want to say something as we wrap up. You know, they asked, I'm sure, I don't know if anyone hasn't seen this documentary, please go and see it. It's the new, it's the latest Nina Simone one that was done by Netflix.
Yes. Yeah.
And they said to her, you know, they pretty much asked her, what is life about for you? Like, what's the one thing that you want? Because she was so rebellious and you know, well, rebellious in inverted commas. and she just said, freedom. Freedom, that's it. Just freedom. And I think for me, that's what this is about. This is just about freedom. It's freedom to be an individual. It's freedom to have a background, freedom to have a place from whence you come, but to have limitless possibilities in terms of where you can go.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me is the biggest thing. We cannot and we should never use this blackness thing to limit people.
Right. I think that's a great way to end it.
Yeah. So as we wrap up, go out there and be yourself. Free the black man, free the black child, Amandla. And so on and so forth.
Free yourself.
We will chat again next week. Andrew, I hope that you've come to understand something about the black narrative after this conversation. If you haven't, and if you're still confused, you know where to find us on Twitter.
We didn't even talk about that.
On Facebook, it's and WeChat.
What's your Twitter?
Rory at Rory Shabalala.
Okay.
If you don't know how to spell Shabalala by now, Nonge.
I have to send a shout out. I think the most valuable contributions today definitely came from Shaka Sisulu. Thanks, Shaka.
Thank you, guys. We'll see you again next week. Follow us on the website www.cliffcentral.com/frankly speaking for more of these kind of conversations. Ciao, ciao.
This is cliffcentral.com.